This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Simmering tensions in the Taiwan Strait got a little hotter this week. On Monday, China's legislature passed an anti-secession law which gives the government advance permission to use force if Taiwan moves towards full independence. In response, Taiwan's president, Chen Shui-bian, called for his people to join a massive public protest later this month. Here in Washington, the Bush administration played down the new law. China's a major trade partner and critical to the administration's hopes of dealings with North Korea. But if there was a conflict, the United States would almost certainly support Taiwan, and analysts worry about the increased possibility of miscommunication or miscalculation. Later in the program, President Bush chooses one of the chief architects of the Iraq War to head the World Bank, and in Iraq, the new parliament meets for the first time to the sound of mortar fire. But first, tensions in the Taiwan Strait. If you have questions about China's ability to back up its threats or the reaction in Taipei and Washington, our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK, and our email address is totn@npr.org. To begin with, we turn to David Shambaugh, author of Modernizing China's Military, to ask about the muscle behind the anti-secession law. And he joins us here in Studio 3A in Washington. Thanks very much for coming in.
Pleasure, Neil.
By the way, if you are a little weak on your geography, there's a map of the Formosa Strait and more information available on our website at npr.org. So why is the strait so tactically important to what we're talking about here?
Well, it's only a 90-mile body of water, similar to what separates Florida from Cuba, but it's also one of the most violent bodies of water in the world. It's very difficult to cross with amphibious landings, for example. Much more difficult, in fact, than was the English Channel during the Second World War.
9 miles wide, not 90. The English Channel.
Right. Yeah. Right. But the point is, it's actually a very volatile body of water in terms of wind, typhoons, and weather. So it does pose some real logistical obstacles to the Chinese military should they ever wish to undertake an amphibious landing on Taiwan, but they certainly have many other options besides that militarily.
And what might those options be? I mean, we know, for example, there are, what, supposedly 500 missiles lined up on the other side of the strait.
Right. At one end of the continuum, they do have that sort of destructive option. There are now more than 600, in fact, short-range ballistic missiles and several hundred more intermediate-range missiles that could be launched to destroy any number of things on Taiwan, both military or civilian targets. But short of that, they've got options to blockade the major ports, north part of the island, Jilung, in the southern part of the island, Kaohsiung, and the major naval base at Zuoying. So a combination of submarines and surface combatants could do that. They've got air capabilities now that could probably take control of the airspace over the Taiwan Strait, if not over Taiwan Island itself. They've got electronic and information warfare capabilities in which they could take down the Taiwan communications infrastructure, both military and civilian. They've got a range of options. So it's far from necessary for them to land a force on the island.
Would those options be viable if the other major player in this calculation, the United States Navy, got involved?
Well, that's one of their major concerns, of course, is to prevent the American intervention and to preempt that, in effect. And if the United States Navy did get involved, they have been preparing for this for some time and have plans and some capabilities to attack U.S. carrier battle groups and indeed American supply bases in Okinawa and Japan.
Now, all of these calculations are based on the fact that China's military has been on an aggressive program of modernization. Now, this is an enormous military structure. Modernizing even a part of it is difficult and expensive, but they've been doing that.
I wouldn't call it aggressive. I would call it a sustained and incremental military modernization program that's been ongoing since the early 1990s, but to be sure has accelerated since the late 90s. And since that time, they have been investing hard resources, average increase in the defense budget of about 14.5% per year, has translated into a number of things, but largely improved salaries for the force. I think it's important to note that they put most of their resources not into hardware, into weapons necessarily, but into the software, if you will, that really does afford a military the ability to fight. There's communications, logistics, training, education, recruitment, and retention. of a military force. So they're not spending billions and billions of dollars on destructive weapons. They're actually spending it on the more software dimensions.
And at the same time, defense budgets on Taiwan have been steady or going down even.
Yes, they've been declining, I think, for 12 consecutive years now. And the arms package that President Bush made available to Taiwan in the first year of his first term, now 5 years ago, is still stuck 5 years later in the Taiwan legislature, who have not to date authorized the monies to make those purchases.
Now, these calculations, given Taiwan's declining abilities and China's advancing ones, does China have the prospect of, in the reasonably short-term future, of being powerful enough to believe that they could overwhelm Taiwan before the United States could intervene?
Well, this is a good question. It's a question of real debate amongst China military watchers. I'm of the view that there is already an imbalance in the favor of the mainland, and that the mainland already has a number of capabilities that are superior to Taiwan's. There are those who believe that the balance is greater and more balanced, and there are those who believe that Taiwan has sufficient capability. So there's a range of views, but clearly the trend line is towards increasing mainland capability. And over time, that's only increasing, while Taiwan's own defense capabilities are decreasing. So it's a question of when rather than whether the balance tips in China's favor.
Mm-hmm. The United States is the preeminent military power on the globe. How safe is the American technical lead?
Oh, far, far beyond what China has or any other nation in the world. In fact, it's a widening gap. China's capabilities really, I think, have to be put in perspective. They're at least 15, if not 20 or more years behind American capabilities across the board, conventionally. Nuclear capabilities, a little less than that. But compared to the American forces, there's no comparison. The question is how the United States would try and wage a defensive war over Taiwan without taking the war to the mainland. After all, the United States doesn't really have a whole lot of experience in this. You know, when you fight a war, the United States fights a war, as we did in Iraq, we tend to take the war to the enemy. All right. Now, if you're going to take the war to the enemy, that means striking mainland China. Striking mainland China is an insane idea and would easily escalate beyond control and would involve, quite likely, nuclear weapons. So, you know, this is something that's got to be really very carefully thought through, not just by the U.S. military, but American politicians. Do we even want to take that first step in the defense of Taiwan?
And you mentioned nuclear weapons. Is there a prospect that obviously the last thing China would want is a Taiwan that's a smoking radioactive hole? This is the last thing anybody on either side wants. Though, do American planners worry about the prospect where, for example, China losing in a conventional struggle with the United States of using nuclear weapons against an American carrier task force group?
I don't think they'd consider doing that, and they certainly wouldn't consider using nuclear weapons against Taiwan, and have at various times in the past said they would not do so. But it is conceivable they would use ballistic missiles against American carriers. And as I say, American rear supply bases in Japan and Okinawa. And they could use them certainly against Taiwan, but nuclear weapons, no.
Okay. European Union, the nations of the European Union, have been moving toward lifting a weapons embargo that was imposed on China after Tiananmen, crushing of the student uprising there. The Europeans try to reassure the United States about this by saying, look, we're not going to be selling them weapons. We're going to be selling them other stuff. But from what you're saying, isn't that software, the electronic ability to coordinate all of their, isn't that exactly what they want?
Exactly. That is what the People's Liberation Army, China's military, needs the most. They've got a pretty adequate supply of weapons from Russia, and they've been buying about $2 billion worth of weapons, aircraft, ships, submarines, and other things from Russia over the last decade, and they have no problems with that source of supply. But what they need, as you suggest, is this sort of integrative technologies, avionics, communications packages, other things, indeed, the Europeans have a comparative advantage in and could sell. Whether the Europeans, the Europeans are going to lift this embargo. That's clear. There's a major European delegation here in Washington right now. It's clear they're going to. It's a question whether they do it in the first half of this year or the second half of this year. The real issue is, after it's lifted, what kind of export controls are put in place in Europe to control the flow of technologies and weapons to China? And there, Briefly, it has to be said the Europeans are quite sensitive now to American concerns and are putting into place a series of new measures to try and restrict the flows of technologies, if not weapons, to China. But that's still not a finished process.
As you look at this situation, obviously politics is dominating the situation this week, but clearly the Chinese military itself is a political factor in these discussions, and the Chinese military has been discussed as a factor that has been taking the hardest line toward Taiwan.
That was certainly true 10 years ago. I think it's less clear today that the Chinese military is the greatest advocate of the use of force against Taiwan. I think the opposite argument could be made. No military likes to be ordered into war without sufficient capability. And in the late 90s, after the 96 Taiwan Straits crisis, the Chinese military very much had the sense that they were being risked to go into conflict against Taiwan without those capabilities. So it's the last 8 years of buildup that has now given them a much greater capability. But I would not say that the Chinese military is an advocate of the use of force at all. Like most militaries, are very prudent and, in fact, maybe risk-averse in this situation. But if ordered by civilians to go to war, they want to be capable, just like any other military.
Mm-hmm. We just have a few seconds with you left. If you were looking ahead towards either side's military, what would you be looking towards in terms of whether they're going to be improving or declining relatively?
Well, I'd see on the China side, the trend lines that we've seen for the last 5, 6, 7 years simply continuing, not necessarily accelerating. But that, over time, does produce a very competent force. This 14.5% budget increase I mentioned, if that doubles the budget in 5 years' time. The real thing is Taiwan. And whether Taiwan is going to allocate the funds necessary for the purchase of American weapons, and even if it does, whether it can absorb and use those weapons. There's sufficient evidence to date that they've had great difficulty in using the weapons the United States has sold it. So I see the balance increasingly tipping towards China's advantage.
David Shambaugh, thanks very much for being with us today. We appreciate it.
You're quite welcome.
David Shambaugh is director of George Washington University's China Policy Program and author of Modernizing China's Military, Progress, Problems, and Prospects. He was kind enough to join us here in Studio 3A. When we come back from a short break, we'll be talking with Professor Vincent Wang, who just returned from a trip to Taiwan. I'm Neil Cownan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Cownan in Washington. We're talking today about Chinese military capabilities, Taiwanese independence, and American objectives in the Far East. We want to hear from listeners from that region. Are you concerned about this tension between China and Taiwan? Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. Taiwan and China view their relationship and their relative positions in the world from very different positions. For the Taiwanese perspective, we turn now to Vincent Wang, professor of political science at the University of Richmond, an expert on Taiwan and a native. He joins us from member station WCVE in Richmond, and it's nice to have you back on Talk of the Nation.
Thank you.
You recently returned from a trip to Taiwan. What was the reaction there to the anti-secession law?
I think the people we met there were very concerned. They think that the law was unnecessary and provocative because the PRC has unilaterally defined the status quo as one of unification, whereas the Taiwanese and the Americans obviously have different definitions of the status quo. And in fact, the peace in the Taiwan Strait was based on the different interpretations of the status quo. They're also worried that this law takes away their democratic rights of self-determination, because most people in Taiwan favor maintaining the status quo so that they can preserve all their options in the future regarding relations with the mainland, including ranging from all the way from unification to independence. But this law mandates unification as the only option. Therefore, this is a unification law. They're also concerned that the conditions authorizing the Chinese government and military to use force are too vague. It's strictly subject to Beijing's interpretation. So this is a war bill. So based on those three conditions, they're very concerned.
Very concerned. Is this the passage of the, is this concern manifesting itself in more support for independence or what?
I think this law certainly does not help in terms of Taiwanese popular attitudes about the mainland, and certainly does not help in terms of the recent reconciliation between the two sides. For example, yesterday there was a poll conducted by the China Times in Taipei. After the passage of this law, 62% of the respondents say that they oppose China passing this bad law. 43% are in favor of holding a defensive referendum, and 23% of the respondents actually say they will turn up to the street on March 26th to protest this law.
Here's an interesting email question we got from Joe Paris. We're in a world affairs class right now in our high school listening to your program. Many of your listeners, like me and my class, are too young to understand clearly why little itty-bitty Taiwan is considered a threat to mainland China.
I think for mainland China, they have been doing pretty well without Taiwan for the last 55 years. The issue of Taiwan for them is one of territorial integrity and sovereignty, in other words, face. But as a practical matter, they can pretty much do without Taiwan. They have been doing that. And of course, they are afraid that if Taiwan permanently separates from the mainland, it could be used by some unfriendly forces against China. But of course, most Taiwan people just want to go on with their life. They have a hard-earned economic miracle and hard-earned democracy, and they are not in the appetite of having Beijing to tell them what they can do or they cannot do.
And Beijing is also concerned that Taiwan might set a precedent for Tibet or Xinjiang or other parts of what are now China.
True, but there's a difference there. In the case of Xinjiang and Tibet, they are under the actual control of the PRC. But in Taiwan, Beijing just simply assert sovereignty over Taiwan. They have no actual control. In fact, the Republic of China, the official name of Taiwan, was founded in 1912, and PRC was founded in 1949. You cannot secede from a territory that you never belonged to. So I think the logic was flawed.
Let's get a listener on the line, and this is Mimi. Mimi's on the line with us from Reno, Nevada.
Yes. I just have a very short comment. I think over the past 110 years, the two societies have diverged significantly politically, socially, and culturally. Although Taiwan has only recently become a true democracy with open elections, I think it will be a huge step backward for Taiwanese to submit to the political system currently in place in China. If reunification were to occur, I think it could only be accomplished to the benefit of Taiwanese if China were to first adopt a democratic form of government. And if China takes over Taiwan, Taiwanese people would lose their freedom of speech as well as high standard of living, given China's record, poor records for civil and human rights. And thank you.
Thanks for the call, Mimi. And Professor Wong, is she? Are there a lot of people on Taiwan who thinks as she does?
I think so. I think many people in Taiwan already can feel the long shadow cast by the PRC. So in a way that democracy in Taiwan is progressing at a faster rate than Beijing can tolerate. But that is not Taiwan's problem. It is Beijing's problem. And you can see already similar things happening in Hong Kong. What is happening in Hong Kong does not prove to be very encouraging in the eyes of many Taiwanese.
And one final question. We heard earlier that in Taiwan, the defense budget has diminished over the last 12 years consecutively. Is that likely to change now?
I think so. Just yesterday, I heard that the with the passage of the anti-secession law, the opposition in the legislature, namely the Pan-Blue camp, sees that national security should be a nonpartisan issue. So this may shore up their determination to help to defend Taiwan's political and economic system from possible Chinese aggression.
Vincent Wong, thank you very much for being with us. We appreciate your time today.
You're welcome.
Vincent Wong, political scientist at the University of Richmond. He joined us from the studios of member station WCVE in Richmond. And joining us now to talk about the American role in this cross-strait showdown is Kenneth Lieberthal, a visiting fellow at the Brookings Institution, former head of White House policy on Asia under President Bill Clinton. And he joins us now from a studio at the Brookings Institution here in Washington, D.C. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Explain to us, there was very little doubt that the government in Beijing had the authority to use force against Taiwan if it wanted to without going to the legislature. Why was this law passed?
I think the reality is that Beijing last year became deeply concerned that their threat to use force if Taiwan takes an irrevocable step toward independence had become itself non-credible, that in Taiwan they no longer believed it when Beijing said, if you push us too far, we're going to have to use our military. So they sought a way to increase their credibility of their threat, but without using force to accomplish that, because using force would itself have all kinds of unwelcome repercussions. What they finally decided on was they would pass a law with a lot of publicity through the National People's Congress that officially declared that they would use force. And although that doesn't really change anything, as your question suggests, on the ground, it nevertheless would direct a lot of attention to this and potentially increase their credibility. So I think that's where this really came from. The actual timing of it and that kind of thing, to my mind, is unfortunate. I think the law itself is unfortunate, but I think that was the purpose behind it.
Now, in an article called Preventing a War Over Taiwan, which is just published in Foreign Affairs, you say that there are is a set of misguided assumptions in each capital that could lead to war.
That's correct. I think that if you look at the assumptions that each side makes as they look at the situation in the U.S., on the mainland, and in Taiwan, you find there are kind of fatal flaws that each of them have in their toolkit, so that you end up with the ironic situation that while all three places, Beijing, Taipei, and Washington, really want stability across the strait, we may in fact find that the way they seek that stability increases instability, as we're seeing just in this past week, where Beijing is trying to stabilize things through increasing the credibility of its threat, even while emphasizing that it wants stability and long-term peace. And the reaction in Taiwan, we still have to see how it unfolds, but it's conceivable it will be one that will ratchet up tensions and start a worrisome spiral.
Let's get some listeners back on the line. And joining us next is Daniel. Daniel's calling from Monterey, California.
Thank you for taking my call, Mr. Cohen.
Mm-hmm. As
terrorism has replaced communism as the great national threat, what net effect will America's quietly increasing debt load with the world's largest communist economy have on our military decision-making?
Oh, I don't think that'll have any effect at all on our military decision-making, frankly. I worry about America's twin deficits, our budget deficit and trade deficit, largely for the long-term impact on the U.S. economy, which in turn could affect our military capabilities down the pike. The Chinese have bought a lot of U.S. sovereign debt. The reality is that makes us mutually dependent. The Chinese don't want to see the U.S. economy go off a cliff because they will lose an enormous amount of money in the process. So I don't think we're going to see China manipulating their holding of our debt for military purposes or strategic purposes. That's really on the economic side, and it makes us mutually interdependent, not one side able to maneuver the other.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for the call, Daniel. Let's go now to Robert, and Robert's with us from San Francisco.
I'd like to note that Taiwan and mainland China also are extremely interdependent today. Trade is at an all-time high, and I think you could speak to that. I would say that today we are projecting our fears in that region, I think, which are fueling the crisis because I think that there has been a move away against diplomacy, and our overextension in Iraq is influencing the problem. I think that Taiwan and China will work out their problems in a mature way rather than falling upon the old childish ways of solving problems by looking toward face. You know, they will become more mature political entities, and they'll solve this problem. And maybe you would take that comment and opinion.
Okay, Robert, thank
well,
you.
I appreciate the comment. I hope you're right. You are certainly right that the amount of trade across the Taiwan Strait is unprecedented. Taiwan has very large-scale capital investments in the mainland. So their hard-headed mutual interests in maintaining stability and growing their relationship on a peaceful basis is well recognized on both sides. And so that's an obstacle to people acting in an irresponsible fashion. But I think we're unfortunately still a considerable distance from leaving issues of faith totally behind. And so I think there's a lot of work to be done to build mutual trust at a political level, which would enable them to realize what they both frankly want to realize, which is long-term stability across the Taiwan Strait.
The new generation of Chinese leadership in Beijing has been given good marks of late for adept diplomacy, particularly in the Far East. Is this a misstep?
I think that the timing of this is especially unfortunate. They teed this up last December, fully expecting, as everyone in Taiwan did, that the political coalition behind Chen Shui-bian, the Pan-Green Coalition, would win a legislative majority in the elections in Taiwan, legislative elections last December, and then would use that majority to push through constitutional changes that Beijing felt it simply would not be able to tolerate. And so Beijing got this law going in their legislative process before that election took place, so that they could roll it out right after the election and then solidify it in their formal annual legislative meeting this March. Turns out, to everyone's surprise, the Pan-Green group did not win a majority in the legislature. So Beijing was already kind of locked in and got stuck with this law at the end of the day. So the timing ended up being unfortunate. The main thing I would say about Hu Jintao in Taiwan, though, is that Hu has made very clear internally in China, within party circles and in the military, that it is not realistic for China to focus on unification with Taiwan in the foreseeable future. Since that goal is not attainable for many, many years to come at best, what they should focus on is stabilizing the cross-strait relationship. And I think that the details of this law and their broader posture are really geared toward long-term stability. But, you know, politics are politics, and some of this is seen in other ways in Taiwan. And so it's an issue that requires a lot of work by everyone to keep on a stable path.
We're talking about reaction to China's anti-secession law. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get Sam on the line. Sam's with us from Jacksonville, Florida.
Yes, sir. I'm just reminded of the enormous miscommunication between China and the United States 50 years ago when the United States went to war on the Korean Peninsula. And that was terrible. But I also was, my question refers to President Bush's support of the One China policy. What does that mean? Thank you.
The One China policy actually has been the U.S. position going back to Harry Truman. The only thing that's changed is which government we recognize as the sole legal government of all of China. But that policy means effectively that we will only recognize one government as the government of China. We will not recognize officially two different governments in different parts of China, unless both of them have agreed peacefully between themselves that they are two legitimate independent governments. And I would not hold your breath for that to occur. In 1979, January of 79, we switched our recognition of that one government from the government in Taiwan, calling itself the Republic of China, to the government in Beijing, calling itself the People's Republic of China.
The United States policy, though, in regards to Taiwan, is based on what you describe in your article. I guess the phrase is strategic ambiguity.
Yes, but the strategic ambiguity is the following. We say to Beijing, and have for a long time, that if you should use force against Taiwan out of the blue, you know, if we regard this as just naked aggression, you cannot assume that we will stand idly by. In other words, you may end up fighting the U.S. military. At the same time, we have no interest at all in Taiwan's provoking military conflict across the strait. So we indicate to Taiwan that if they act in a wildly provocative fashion, they cannot safely assume that we will come to their rescue if the mainland responds. Effectively, we're trying to deter each from taking a fateful step toward military conflict.
And what you have advocated in this article, and I'm afraid we only have 30 seconds for you, is that the United States take a diplomatic move now and try to get both sides to agree to a 20, 30-year status quo. Freeze it.
Exactly right. Where in an agreement that lasts for decades, Beijing would commit not to use force across the strait and Taiwan would commit not to declare independence over the full course of that agreement.
Thank you very much, Kenneth Lieberthal. We appreciate your time today.
My pleasure. Good to talk to you.
Kenneth Lieberhothal was head of President Clinton's policy on Asia. He's a visiting fellow at the Brookings Institution's Center for Northeast Asian Policy Studies, and he joined us from a studio at the Brookings Institution here in Washington, D.C. And again, you can find a map of the Taiwan Strait and further coverage at our website, npr.org. When we come back from a short break, President Bush today made a controversial choice to head the World Bank. Deputy Defense Chief Paul Wolfowitz. We'll hear about his qualifications and the international response. We'll also talk about today's first meeting of Iraq's elected assembly. All that coming up after the break. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.